It's assessment day. Yeah. Storm damage covers more than 750 miles of the Midwest, and we're trying to figure out just how severe the damage was. Right now, unfortunately, the markets are saying there wasn't enough done to impact supplies.
Live from a much calmer day via Farm Journal broadcast, this is AgriTalk. This morning, we'll talk with Michael Clark and Kirk Hinz from BAM WX. Then we've got Chuck Connor, the president of the National Council of Farmer Cooperatives. In the final segment, Brian Grady, editor of Pro Farmer. And right after the news, Annalisa Laca from Farm Journal's Milk. I'm handsome newsman David Michelson via telephone. Now the host of AgriTalk, Chip Flory.
All right, Davis.
Can you hear me?
Wow.
Am I coming through?
We got you, man. We got you loud and clear. We're dealing with some of the storm damage is my guess. I mean, internet service across that storm area is sketchy at best right now.
Well,
buddy.
And yeah, Ted the Hammer Hamer noted that a lot of those taller grain bins had internet relay devices on them, which, you know, is above my pay grade scientifically, but maybe we're dealing with something like that here, but I'm at the home office without internet at the time being.
Exactly. Yeah, we're going to be talking with Chuck Connor about that. One of the big efforts at the National Council of Farmer Cooperatives is getting broadband coverage, expanding coverage, getting better service out there in rural America, and not just for the cooperatives, but for the residents of rural America. So we're going to have a conversation with him about that and just, you know, try to gauge whether or not the storms might have set that effort back a bit. And what we'll talk about it with him. But what terrible timing for this. We've got schools all across the Midwest trying to figure out, do we go back to face-to-face school or do we keep things try to do the online schooling, the virtual schooling.
Mm-hmm.
It's as frustrating as can be for the administrators out there right now. I can't even imagine trying to make these decisions. It's really tough, really tough. Okay. Hey, let's jump into it. Did you have the ability to gather some news this morning?
I actually did. We can start with state's progress.
You're cutting out on us. Let's bring in John Harith, the news director at Farm Journal. John, are you able to join us here this morning?
Yes, I am.
A little bit better than Davis, I hope.
Yeah. So it's been one of those time periods in here that we are looking at. Just the focus is on, are we going to get another round of payments, right? When's the next round of aid come?
Right, and, you know, there is no motion in Washington right now on that, which, and the House is saying that the House is not set to come back until September 14th, right. Although they could obviously call them back if they have a deal put together. One bright spot, though, for agriculture that Jim Wiesmeyer and I talked about in last week's Signal to Noise podcast, mm-hmm. is that you've got some $8 billion left in unpaid CFAP money right now. You've got another $14 billion in CCC money, although some of that is committed. But there is some latitude for USDA and some bank for USDA to make some moves on their own if they decide to do that and if these talks go on too long.
Okay. All right. Very interesting. Hey, real quick, we should go over some of the news that I'm sure that Davis was going to cover, because we had the crop progress report yesterday and the crop condition report. USDA, as of August 9th, had 97% of the U.S. corn crop silking, 59% in the dough stage, 11% dented, and the corn crop was rated 71% good to excellent soybeans. 92% blooming. I don't know which ones aren't by now, but yeah. 75% are setting pods, 74% good to excellent, which was an increase in the crop condition ratings and is part of the reason that soybeans are having a tough time moving to the upside, despite the fact that we had another 132,000 metric tons of soybean sales announced for the new crop marketing year. Spring wheat, 15% harvested, 69% good to excellent. Cotton, 42% good to excellent. Winter wheat is 90% harvested right now. The Chinese inflation, I think Davis was probably going to cover this as well. Chinese inflation is a bit stronger than expected with pork prices climbing. Get this, China's consumer price index climbed 2.7% in July, which was a tenth of a point higher than analysts surveyed by Reuters expected, and an increase from 2.5% growth in June. Much of the increase was driven by an increase in food prices and pork in particular. This is what I was looking for here. Food prices in China, 13.2% higher year over year last month. Pork prices up 85.7%.
Holy smokes.
Yes. Yeah, 85.7.
Let's ship them some more U.S. pork.
Why shouldn't we? Both figures are up from June when food prices climbed 11.1% and pork prices were up 81.6%. So big jump in year-over-year pork prices in the month of July. So lots of movement there. Real quick, an update on the pandemic. The U.S. reported fewer than 50,000 new coronavirus cases for the second consecutive day, even as the number of cases worldwide surpassed 20 million. More than 49,000 new cases were reported in the U.S., pushing total number close to 5.1 million. The nation's death toll exceeded 163,000. All right, John, thanks, buddy, for giving me a little relief there. Appreciate that.
Sure thing.
Yeah, all right. Let's bring in Annalisa Laca. How are you, Annalisa?
I'm doing great. How are you, Chip?
Doing okay. Let's talk some storm damage. What are you hearing from dairy country?
Yeah, so in parts of Iowa where you are, one of the main problems that they're facing at this point is power, you know, lack of power obviously requires power to milk cows. And some of those farms in Iowa are small enough that a lot of them don't have the significantly sized generators needed to run a dairy barn. So
right.
Seeing some of that becoming an issue, some of that's getting sorted out. I think, you know, as you'd expect, some of those cows are being moved to places that do have power. Some, you know, generators are being scrounged up in communities and things are getting taken care of. As we move further north up into Wisconsin, seeing lots of reports of damage to forage crops, which could become a significant issue for them because we were already tight on forages in parts of Wisconsin. So that storm yesterday produced some tornadoes up there that caused some damage to barns, but also wiped out significant swaths of silage corn in parts of the state. So definitely a host of issues that we're trying to sort out this morning.
Yeah, Annalisa, that corn crop, the silage corn crop, southern Wisconsin was looking so good this year too.
Yeah.
You know, there hasn't been a lot of ear development and don't have a lot of dry corn that out there that was ready for chopping, but I got a feeling that guys are going to be doing some things that's going to look really kind of weird if they've got a bunch of green snap out there in the next 48 hours. They're going to get busy.
Well, and you know, that's one of the, you know, if you want to talk about silver linings for a dairy producer compared to, you know, we don't like to compare farmers, but compared to a grain producer, we can chop that corn when it's down. It's not ideal, but it can be done.
Absolutely. Annalisa, thank you so much. We'll talk to you later.
Thanks, Chip.
That's Annalisa Laca, the editor of Farm Journal's Milk. Okay, we're going to put some boundaries on the storm damage with the guys from BAMWX next. No doubt you've heard of MetLife, but did you know that MetLife Investment Management has over 100 years of ag lending experience? The MetLife Investment Management team maintains close relationships with its borrowers and can structure a customized loan with flexible terms to meet your financial needs. Looking to expand, refinance, or recapitalize? Consider MetLife Investment Management. Learn more at MetLife.com/ag.
AgriTalk is brought to you by Pioneer. For the best agronomic advice for your farm, count on your local Pioneer team for year-round advice. Pioneer, an American seed brand since 1926.
All right. Hey now, you. All right, welcome back. I'm your host, Chip Flory, and we are going to try to put some assessment on how much damage was done yesterday. And let's start with the guys at BAMWX.com. Michael Clark joins us right now. Michael, it's good to talk with you again. How are you?
Good, Chip. How you doing, buddy?
Not too bad. Not too bad. Kirk Hens, also a meteorologist at BAMWX. How are you, Kirk?
I'm well, sir. I'm well. Thank you for having us.
You bet. You bet. First things first, Michael, explain what a derecho is, how it, how this one happened, and how rare are they?
Yeah, I mean, so a derecho is basically a area of thunderstorms that produces damage for at least 250 miles with concentrated wind gusts of over 60 to 70 miles per hour. This particular derecho went for quite a bit longer than that. It went for a total of 770 miles in a short duration of 14 hours. So its average speed was 55 miles an hour from west
to east. It's crazy.
Yeah. And, you know, one like this, its occurrence is probably every, I would say, 4 to 5 years, once every 4 to 5 years. The interesting part about this one was its direct placement over the heart of the Corn Belt.
It ran down Highway 30.
I mean, couldn't have been worse placement, especially for the time of year.
Yeah, Kirk, I couldn't believe how well it held together.
Yeah.
And as it was making the move, the northern end of it, the southern end of it, was spinning up other severe storms, wasn't it?
Yeah. It was just one of those days where, one, the models were not handling it well. And then we saw early yesterday morning, we're like, the bells were going off because there were no storms out ahead of it. Clear skies, warm temperatures, perfect ingredients for a storm cluster to survive for hundreds of miles. And we saw it right away, and we're just like, man, this is not going to be good. And with all of that energy that was out ahead of it, it was just spawning so many storms and even some tornadoes out there as well. I think just within the derecho, there was like 550 damaging wind reports, which is not normal by any means. You may have something like that, like Michael said, every 4 or 5 years. So it's extremely rare. And like he also said, you know, bad time of the year, unfortunately. We're thinking of folks out there and praying hard.
Yeah, absolutely. Michael, wind gust, what was the highest that you heard and where?
Yeah, that would have been in Marshalltown, Iowa. The Marshallton Airport, I believe, is what it was. I believe the ASOS it maxed out at 99.9 miles per hour, but I believe it was actually 101 mile per hour wind gust. I didn't see one higher than that, Kirk, did you?
I saw one I think it was a little bit east that got up to 112 that was verified, which is from straight line winds. That's like taking a power pole and snapping it in half.
Yeah. And there was some of that damage reported, right?
Very widespread.
Just west of Des Moines. So from Des Moines to Marshallton, just east, that was where the derecho was at its strongest point.
Yeah.
In that 30 mile radius, you had 6 and 8. He had 14 wind gusts that were greater than 70 miles per hour. So just in that concentrated area. Yeah, it was remarkable. Yeah. I mean, you've seen these grain bins just collapse from that, you know.
Right. The other thing that I think people need to understand that weren't in the middle of this storm is that it wasn't just the big wind gust came along and then it was gone.
Yes.
These people had to sustain these high winds for more than 30, 35 minutes.
Yeah. The wind behind it was, I saw some areas were sustaining winds for 50 miles per hour for a half an hour. That's almost tropical storm criteria right there. It's not normal. Not normal even for a storm cluster.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, okay. Go ahead, Michael.
Oh, I was just going to say, when you think about that, the duration, normally wind, severe wind gusts are about 3 seconds, Chip.
Yeah. Yeah.
So when you start adding up multiple minutes at a crop's mature stage, you can imagine just how detrimental that is to the crop.
Yeah, and if we're wondering why, like you were talking about, Michael, why there was so much damage done to grain bins, you hit them hard and they bounce back. You hit them sustained, yep, like we did, and they start to collapse.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep.
Unbelievable. Yeah, I've got family that we were on the very, very north edge. I mean, our trees, you know, moved a little bit for a short period of time. But I've got family that was right in the middle of this, you guys. My daughter-in-law described it as being in a tornado for 45 minutes.
Yeah. I mean, she's not off base with that. I mean, that's yeah, pretty accurate, especially if you're, you know, technically a severe wind gust, Chip, is by NWS definition is 58 miles per hour. So anything 58 or stronger is severe weather. So if you're in that for 30 minutes, it's like you're in a tropical storm.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, so.
Unbelievable. Okay, West Edge, yeah, where is it?
Sorry, say that again?
Where's the, like west edge of the damage?
Yeah. It looked like northeastern Nebraska is where it really started going. Maybe you have some different idea, Michael.
No, it's definitely extreme. The far eastern county row butting up to Iowa is where the damage started. Okay. And the east edge ended in northwest Ohio. So, again, it was about 770 miles.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Which was crazy, too. Another thing cool about it, or not cool about it, but from a weather standpoint, was it was creating severe wind gusts just south of the actual main cluster, is what we call like a shelf cloud or outflow boundary. Like you see that big shelf cloud in the air, and usually it's not, you know, too strong of wind. It has a nice wind gust, but these were 60-plus mile-an-hour shelf clouds. Those are things that don't even have precipitation with it, but they come overhead and they are severe. There were severe warnings just for those, and that's a powerful storm cluster.
Right, right. Okay, north to south, yep, what does it look like as we try to measure this thing out?
Yeah, the furthest north damage is going to come in the far southern county row of Wisconsin there towards Milwaukee. And then the furthest south damage, it looks like you're spanning about 350 miles, which goes down towards Columbus, Indiana. Now, it sprawled out the further east it got, so it started to stretch itself a little bit. But, you know, for example, in the where the most, I guess, crop is, you know, from Iowa to Illinois, you're looking at about 100-mile wide swath of damage across about 500 miles in distance.
Yep, agreed.
So when you start talking about square miles covered, it's a lot.
It's yeah. A lot. No doubt it's a lot.
Yeah. And so it's hard to say, hey, the drought areas in Iowa got rain. That's great. Well, the people that got rain, I don't know if they're when you couple it with what they got, you might as well just have not got the rain.
Yeah.
Right.
Perspective.
Right.
Yeah.
So, you know, the last time that something like this happened, at least in central Iowa, I think it was July of 2011, and the crop was – It was moving right along in 2011, but it wasn't nearly as mature as what this is. I mean, we're 4 weeks later than what it was in 2011, yeah, something like that. So in 2011, it knocked it down, it stood up, and we still made a corn and soybean crop. There are guys that will argue that in 2011 that they had a good yield, but they still left 15 to 20 bushel on the ground because of green snap and underdeveloped ears that were laying on the ground, stuff like that. So this year, it all depends on how well that corn if that corn can even stand back up at this point.
Yeah.
It was more prone to green snap this time around, you guys. We've got some real issues that we're going to have to be watching over the next week before we get out there on the road on crop tour. This is an incredible event that happened on this crop. I don't think I'm overplaying it. Michael, Kirk, thank you so much for your time and for putting some assessment on this. 500 miles, 100 miles north to south of some damage out there to the crops. Thank you, guys. We'll talk to you again later. Wow. Unbelievable. You bet. You bet. Okay, when we come back, we're going to have a conversation with Chuck Connor from the National Council of Farm Cooperative.
AgriTalk is brought to you by Pivot Bio Proven, predictable, productive, weatherproof. Get a reliable partner. Get the new nitrogen. Get Pivot Bio Proven.
Time for Markets Now with the experts from Pro Farmer.
And joining us now is Pro Farmer editor Brian Grady. Beach had another announcement this morning, but it's kind of like, oh, if you don't get an announcement, that would be the news now, right?
Right. You know, China buys in binges here and 5 days in a row now. The previous streak was 10 days in a row. And so, the market's kind of become used to it. Like you said, it's almost the news if they don't buy soybeans on a daily basis. So providing a little bit of price support today, but not a whole lot, to be honest with you. And really, there isn't a whole lot of price support in the corn or soybean markets this morning. Still trying to digest, I think, the crop damage or potential crop damage from yesterday's derecho that pushed across the Iowa and then into Illinois and parts of Indiana.
Right, absolutely. We're still trying to figure out just how the corn crop will recover, if it's going to be able to recover from some of the damage that we've seen out there. This is a pretty unusual event. Okay, take us over to the livestock trade. What's happening there?
Well, live cattle market, we did see firmer cash trade last week, so we saw strength in the futures yesterday, reflecting a little bit more strength this morning. Expectations are that the cash market will strengthen again, but we'll see, and it's probably a slow go from here forward as we wait on that cash trade to develop. On the hog side of things, we've got the August contract trading to the upside, but all the deferred contracts are under pressure. Slight to moderate pressure, but still trading to the downside this morning.
Gotcha. Okay. Hey, stick around, Beach, for the final segment this morning. We want to talk about how Crop Tour is going to handle all those flat cornfields out there and how we're going to do measurements on those. That's Brian Grady, Pro Farmer Editor.
Opinions expressed on AgriTalk do not necessarily reflect the views of Farm Journal Broadcasting, affiliate stations, or sponsors. America's conservation ag movement would like to recognize the Pork Checkoff for its efforts in contributing to healthier, more resilient production agriculture systems. To learn more, visit agweb.com/ACAM.
Welcome back to AgriTalk. I'm your host, Chip Flory. It's assessment day. We're trying to figure out just how much damage has been done out there. And when we first contacted Chuck Connor, president and CEO of the National Council of Farmer Cooperatives, we did not have storm assessment on the agenda. But unfortunately today, Chuck, we do have to take a look at how much damage was done out there. Welcome to AgriTalk.
Oh, Chip, thanks for having me on. And boy, it's been quite a morning. These poor folks in the Midwest, this is a big one, and our heart goes out to them.
Yeah, absolutely. Any early read on the amount of damage that your members might have suffered?
Well, I was assessing things early this morning, and actually spoke to one of our big members, Heartland Co-op.
Yep.
Based there in Des Moines, and their initial assessment was, they've had over 60 grain bins damaged at 21 different locations. I think their big problem was they believe they may have some facilities that have been knocked out enough that they are not going to be operational for fall harvest, and obviously the implications there are going to play out for a long time for producers in those regions.
60 you said bins, 60, yeah. 60 bins.
Yeah, 60 yeah. bins damaged. And I noticed it because, you know, when I got my news clips this morning, I could see, you know, one facility where the bins were not only damaged, but they were just totally taken out. And I could
right.
see that it was a Heartland facility. So I immediately asked them, and they just, it came right through the middle of their territory. And I'm sure there's yeah. many other members as well.
Yeah, the damage up there around Marshalltown was pretty impressive yesterday too, and it's just incredible. Like we were talking about with the guys from BAMWX, when you put that much pressure on those grain bins for such an extended period of time, it's not like these wind gusts blew through in a couple of minutes. It was more than 35, even 45 minutes. That these bins had to sustain those winds, and they just gave up. They just gave up.
Yep.
Absolutely incredible.
Well, and as you know too, Chip, this is not the right time of year for that either, because most
no.
of those grain bins are empty, and that greatly impacts their ability to withstand this kind of pressure. So
right,
it's right. You know, this is a big one, and it's going to have market implications. I think we'll see how the markets react, not only to the, you know, the damage and infrastructure, but obviously there's a lot of crops on the ground out there that
yep.
It's questionable how much is salvageable, and we'll
right.
just have to see on that.
Right, exactly. Yeah, not a time to go dark on your co-op. Make a phone call. Find out if you were planning on making deliveries to a co-op this fall, make sure that they are going to be in position to take it. Another thing with some of these grain bin setups, Chuck, and I know that this is getting to a point that or to a subject that you're pretty passionate about, but a lot of those grain bins had signal boosters for cell phones, for internet up top, and you've got the American Connection Project that you are supporting at NCFC.
Yes.
And it, you know, with what's going on with the schools and everything, that the need for improved connectivity is so evident out in rural America, and this is going to set it back.
Well, it really is, Chip. And then, you know, this is one of those things where, you know, there's no such thing as an early assessment, because this is just a problem that permeates throughout rural America. And, you know, we're just going to have to see what all of this means. We know we already had a big problem, and, you know, we've been working hard with all of our partners to try and make sure that this is being recognized. And I think it is. I believe that our policymakers now realize that rural America is behind the curve when it comes to these connectivity issues. And this storm sure didn't help. And whether it's on a grain bin or a tower or anything else, I mean, this is not good news. And I think, you know, Chip, the one piece of good news I would add out there is this thing has gotten national attention. And,
yep.
you know, I'll be surprised if you don't see some, you know, very, very high level public officials touring this damage. And whether it's, you know, disaster declarations, financial aid, there's going
right.
to be partners come forward here in a very, very big way to help recover from this. And I just feel very confident in that.
Yeah, I agree, Chuck. I think that is very much the case. Let's talk about some of the aid that is coming from USDA and the Commodity Credit Corporation funding. Just
yes.
over $7 billion of CFAP dollars have been delivered, but that's not even half, and we're coming right up on a deadline for sign-up on this. What is the situation? Why aren't we closer to the $16
billion? Well, Chip, we've been part of a group, and we're calling for an extension of that sign-up deadline.
Okay.
You know, this is not like a regular farm program, although, you know, maybe in some regions, like we've been talking about, it seems like it, but, you know, this is available to dozens and dozens of commodities in regions that don't typically have, you know, farm programs at all.
Mm.
So, you know, our point of view all along is that, you know, FSA needed more time to process this than what was being allowed, and we've called upon an extension of that because this is not a farm program, Chip. It's emergency aid for a once in a generation or perhaps several generation disaster. And it's not about running things in a timely manner. It's about making sure that nobody gets left behind that is eligible for assistance. And I fear where we are right now, if this thing were to shut off, there wouldn't be people left behind that just simply didn't get processed. Maybe their commodity didn't get approved until just a few weeks ago, and so they weren't able to get their paperwork together. Again, that's nobody's objective here. The objective here is that anybody who qualifies should get the help almost without regard, you know, to time limitations. And I say that having run an agency, and I know you've got to run things, you know, on time, but this is not about time. This is about helping those that have been hit by this crisis.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Chuck, I don't know if we've ever had anybody on the program with as much experience in implementing programs and trying to do what is right to provide support for agriculture than you. The time that you've spent at USDA, at the White House, what do you make of the CFAP? And the reason that I'm asking this, Chuck, is because Colin Peterson thinks that the House Ag Committee, the Senate Ag Committee, should have much more say over how this program is being implemented than what they've had, which is a roundabout way of saying that he doesn't really, that USDA could have handled it better. What's your take on it?
Well, you know, I've been in both positions, Chip. I've worked in Congress for the Senate Ag Committee, and I've been the person, you know, running the programs as well. And there's always a balance. And I'll say this, you know, in defense of Secretary Perdue, he was given a time frame to, you know, to implement things that frankly I don't know that I would have wanted to been in charge of. Certainly,
right.
you know, we were never asked to sort of put a brand new program available, again, not just to the program crops. You know, this is available
right
to, is it 60, I believe, is the number, commodities out there?
I think so, yeah.
So, I mean, this is totally different, way more challenging, and among farmers who probably didn't even know what the FSA office was.
Right.
So, again, you know, I can offer no criticism there because he put something in place quickly. Money has been delivered. Obviously, we don't think it's met all of the eligibility out there, which is why we'd like to see the greater time for sign up. And of course, Congress is debating additional funding for this program. So I'm not going to second guess any of that because it's been done
at
rapid speed. But at the same time, you know, congressional oversight is always important. We did a lot of that. And they, you know, it's important to keep your, you know, your congressional colleagues in the loop on what's going on here. And Colin Peterson and the ag committees, they don't want to try and mess things up. You know, there's a lot of politics in Washington today, but these are people that strictly have the farmers' interest in mind. So, you know, there needs to be cooperation between them.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Just for some perspective, non-specialty crop producers have received $1.85 billion of the $7 billion in CFAP payments. The cattle guys got this figured out in a hurry. More than $3 billion have gone out to the cattle producers.
Yep.
The ones that are slowest on the uptake here, I think, are probably the specialty crop producers.
Right.
Just $305 million.
Yep. And that, you know, that doesn't seem right, you know, given the extent of the damage and given the fact that just common sense would tell you that in many ways, they were probably the most impacted by this notion of having all of their production geared towards, you know, kind of the restaurant business. And all of a sudden,
right,
you know, that market was not available to them. So
exactly.
they, you know, I think time is important here and we'll get this figured out if we give them a little more time.
Okay, very good, very good. Chuck, here's the deal. I want to help you promote the American Connection Project, so we need to get you back on and talk about that some more. And as you get some further assessments on the amount of damage that was done out there, we need to get an update from you on that as well. Chuck, thank you so much.
I appreciate it, Chip. You have a good day.
You bet. That is Chuck Connor. He is the president and CEO of the National Council of Farmer Cooperatives. We're going to be right back, have a conversation with Brian Grady from Pro Farmer.
AgriTalk is brought to you by America's Conservation Ag Movement, a national partnership to help farmers scale conservation for their businesses, the environment, and their communities. To learn more, visit agweb.com/ACAM. AgriTalk is brought to you by Smart Nutrition MAP plus MST. Learn how to boost your soil's performance and maximize ROI with Smart Nutrition MAP plus MST at smartnutritionmst.com.
Welcome back to AgriTalk. I'm your host, Chip Flory. We're going to have a conversation right now with Brian Grady, Pro Farmer Editor. He's getting ready for next week's Pro Farmer Crop Tour, 28th Crop Tour, Brian. Is that right?
That's correct, Chip.
All right. I'm going to throw this out there, and we're going to throw it out a couple of times. Just go to profarmer.com, and there is a red banner scrolling at the top of the page, at the top of the home page. You can click on that banner, and it will take you to a registration site where you can sign up to be a part of the evening meetings. This is the first time, and admittedly, it's been kind of forced on you at Pro Farmer because of the meeting restrictions. We can't gather 400 or 500 people together in a location like we've done for the last several years. But you can go to profarmer.com, click on that red banner, and you can get signed up to attend the evening meetings from the Crop Tour. The sign-up is free. Not only is sign-up free, so are the meetings. So you can get real-time information. And most importantly, Beej, we just barely touched on this the last time we talked. You can get real-time analysis of some of that data that's being released that night too, right?
Yeah, definitely. We'll do those that have attended the evening meetings in the past. It'll be very similar. The difference will be that we'll have the eastern side and the western side combined instead of having two separate meetings in two different locations. So the virtual aspect of that brings both sides together, and we'll give you both sets of data each evening and the analysis of the data from Jeff Wilson and myself. It'll be similar in some ways and different in others.
Right. Seems like every year, Beej, something happens that throws some question marks into how the tour is going to operate. The tour has operated the same way since Illinois Farm Bureau had it in the 70s. Jim Quinton had it in the 80s. Pro Farmer then started running the tour in 1993, and has been doing it ever since. But it's been done the same way for the last 40-50 years. And I assume that with the storm damage that we had yesterday, the damage is what it is. It's not going to change how the tour is conducted, right?
Absolutely right. If we happen to stop, we stop randomly along our designated routes. If where you stop is a field that has down corn, the job becomes more difficult, but you still pace out into the field as you would. You have to count the ears in 2 30-foot a row and measure that. We'd pull ears 5, 8, and 11 off of one of those 2 30-foot rows. So the measurements are exactly the same. The job just becomes more difficult, and it takes a little bit longer on that particular stop. So undoubtedly, we will have stops where there's down corn, and it's just up to the scouts to follow the procedure and get the data out of the field.
And following the procedure means straightening up those rows so that we're not counting extra ears that are falling over from an adjacent row. Straightening up those rows, making sure that the stalk is still attached, it hasn't broken off below the ear. If the stalk is broken off above the ear, we're still going to go ahead and count that as a viable ear if it is making grain. Obviously, if the stalk is broken off below the ear, it's not going to be counted because it's not a viable ear any longer. So it's in this case, in a year like this, Beej, all of a sudden, the notes that the scouts make become that much more important, don't they?
Yeah, and that's one of the in the app that we do use. That's one of the options, is put notes in the end. So obviously, in that case, you would mark it down as lodged and or green snapped or whatever the case may be. But like you said, that it just, you know, requires getting down on your hands and knees in those fields and taking time. I did one field a couple of years ago that was heavily lodged, and it took us 20 minutes to get the sample. I mean, that's right. Well beyond what it normally would take, but you do what you have to do, and you get the right data out of the field. So it
right.
becomes, like I said before, just becomes more challenging.
Right. Now, it's important to stress that when we do get into those fields, or when the scouts get into those fields, we're going to be measuring biological yield potential. Even if we measure it accurately, we're not saying that that is what is going to be pulled from that field, because there's probably going to be increased harvest loss. But it's a snapshot in time, and that is the biological yield potential in that field, the way that we measure it.
Right, and that's the reason that at the end of the week, after we're all done with all the yep. samples, our best number is still the average of all the total samples we've collected. So in years past, that number has been upwards of 1,500 on corn right. and on soybeans. This year, it's not going to be that high. We don't have as right. many scouts because of COVID restrictions and stuff like that. I've talked about that here on your show.
Right.
Before, but so our sample numbers will be down some. We want to get a representative sample from each of the crop districts that we've had in the past.
Exactly, and that's what I'm going to be watching very, very closely. I'm working with Emily Carlin, who has been handling our data for the last few years. I'm going to be working with her, making sure that it is that we don't weight the estimates too heavily to one crop district or another based on the number of samples that we've pulled from those districts in the past. Once again, just go to profarmer.com and you can get registered for the crop tour meetings, or you can go to farmjournalfielddays.com, and at farmjournalfielddays.com you can register for crop tour. You can register for the August 25th, 27th Farm Journal Field Days. And you can register for the benefit concert that is happening on August 27th at farmjournalfielddays.com. Beej, we'll talk to you again soon. Thanks, buddy. Appreciate it.
Yep, you betcha, Chip.
All right, that is Pro Farmer editor Brian Grady and director of the Pro Farmer Crop Tour. He's the leader of the Eastern leg out there. Come back this afternoon. We got Dwayne Bussey from Bolt Marketing, and tomorrow morning, Senator Chuck Grassley from Iowa.